I think the first time Cecilia and I were together was maybe with Electronic Hearth.
That's right.
Which was her, it introduced me to things about television I'd never thought about. And so it was great to have her accept when I called her, and she's been back again and again and again. She did a book on muckraking called Exposés and Excess, and her most recent book's on the progressives. Seven figures in our history who've made such a difference because of their strong stands in moving the country forward, sometimes against great odds. And now, as you know, the rule that Will Akers has given them, each reads the other's work, and so they'll get to talk to each other, answering Will's questions about their work, and then all of you will get a chance to talk to them as well. We're really proud to be here at the library. Donna Nicely, former director of the library, welcomed us, and Ken Oliver, her successor, has made it possible for Elaine Elise to continue to welcome us. And now David taking a semester at Vanderbilt, during which he's going to teach about political biographies. And you know, he did first in his class, which was Bill Clinton. He did The Prince of Tennessee, which was Al Gore. In between, he took a deep breath and went for Vince Lombardi. And he did, I think, the definitive work on the Olympics that changed our time, the Olympics of 1960 in Rome. So that, you know, there's a lot of diversity in their work, and a lot of it's going to be reflected in their conversation together today. I always want to thank my friend Will Akers, who is, some of you know, is now launching a new film program at Belmont University. His book on screenwriting everybody interested in screenwriting gets Akers' book and learns how to write screenplays. He's going to teach that now at Belmont, and the program's well underway. So with that, I want to thank each of you for coming. I hope you'll come back each time. I think these sessions are the most interesting. They're far more interesting than a word on words. Part of the reason for that is the interviewer, Will Akers.
Oh, thanks. Wow. Go call my parents. First of all, thank you all for coming to the fourth meeting of the Writer's Circle. Please sign the sign-in sheet. We need a winner for the Mercedes. It's fun for me to be able to say this because we're ahead of the game now. Our next Writer's Circle is April 7th. Our guests are going to be Jay McInerney and Gary Fiskejohn. Gary is editor-at-large at Knopf. He works with writers Julian Barnes, Ray Carver, Tim Gotro, Patricia Highsmith, Cormac McCarthy, and Haruki Murakami, and I cut that list by about two-thirds. Jay has written 11 books. Bright Lights, Big City is one of nine generation-defining novels of the 20th century, said Time magazine, and How It Ended, a collection of short stories spanning his entire career, was named one of the 10 best books of 2009 by the New York Times. So your homework for April 7th is to read How It Ended by Jay McInerney, and Gary wants you to read Max Perkins by A. Scott Berg. And both books are in the National Public Library. So let's get started. I think that's what I need to tell you. First thing I want to do, they've each read each other's book, which is a lot of work for somebody who's been asked to come and speak and not get paid. And then second of all is the handout that you've got with the pages, is they have some thoughts about each other's pages that I want to just start with that. So if you will lead off, please, Cecilia, talking about the pages.
Glad to do it, and I think we all have the photocopies of David's book, pages 278 and 279, but so hold those pages. But I just want to point out a line or two that David writes on page 297. If you have his book and you don't have copies of that, I just want to read this line, because we remember that our president is a writer, his two books. And it's a line here in which David talks about really the temperament of a writer. What is a writer about? Writing comes easily, it says to Barack Obama, but he talks as well very clearly about the characteristics we all need as writers, and that is to hold back, to observe, hang back, look around, absorb, remember, distill, and rearrange. And the last thing we do is rearrange. But I just would like to read this line again. Hang back, that's, you don't get into the center ring. Look around, cultivate that eye, take notes. Absorb, really think, what do those notes say to you? What does it mean? Remember, and of course, if you write down or copy out, you've got a basis for remembering. Distill, like fine liquor, get the essence of it, and then create your own arrangement. Rearrange. This is a line about Barack Obama, but it applies to any writer. So that's just a real gem in David's book. Now, I chose these pages 278 and 9, and I'm going to read them and ask that you follow along. It's a place in which, down about two-thirds on 279, we have a kind of summary of Barack Hussein Obama and where he's positioned and how. And I want to suggest that we're learning about Obama, but we're also having reminders to us as readers of where we have been. This book spans continents, the globe, an amazing book. We remember that the founder of Time magazine, Henry Luce, said that the 20th century would be the American century. Well, this is a book in which we see America as a global distillation of our presidency. Africa, South Asia and Indonesia, the United States of America, deep into our country in Kansas. So very difficult for a writer to keep all these continents present before us. So here's what we come to on 278, down past that space, about two-thirds of the way down. Leaving and being left were the repeated themes of Barry Obama's young life. His mother leaving his father leaving the family, mother and son leaving Honolulu for Seattle, mother and son leaving Hawaii for Indonesia. Son leaving Indonesia for Hawaii. Son being left with his grandparents in Hawaii. Mother and father rejoining him in Hawaii and leaving him again for Indonesia and Kenya. All in the continuum of the family history. Ruth Armour Dunham leaving life altogether as a young mother, having committed suicide. Her boys being left twice in succession, first by her, then by their father. Stan and Madeline leaving again and again, leaving El Dorado in search of El Dorado, leaving Kansas for California, leaving Kansas for Oklahoma and Texas, leaving Kansas for Mercer Island, leaving Mercer Island for Hawaii. Obama's also leaving and being left. Nilotic ancestors leaving the southern Sudan. Obong's leaving, I can't pronounce this, for Kanye Yang. Hussein Onyango, four generations leaving and then we have more African names, wives and children being left by men, men leaving towns for cities, Barack Obama leaving Lualand for Nairobi, leaving Nairobi for America, leaving Ketia for Anne, leaving Hawaii for Harvard, being left by Ruth. Well, we're gasping by this point. And we have all this to-ing and fro-ing, this coming and going, leaving. Now, I want to suggest that as a writer, David is doing double duty in this passage. Very important. One thing he's telling the reader is about the mobility, the restlessness, the sort of nomadism of Barack Obama's ancestry and young Barry Obama caught up in this nomadic, restless, incessant movement. So he's telling us about the world that Barack Obama has come out of. He's doing something else as well. By now, we are close to 300 pages into the book. We are being asked now to remember everything we've read. Now, in the guise of telling us about Obama's family and its history, David is also telling us what we need to remember before he moves his story forward. He's very sly about this. He doesn't say, reader, listen up. Here's what you've read for the last almost 300 pages. Now, get on it. And here's some more you have to remember about Barry Obama. He intertwines what he's telling us about the young, later to be president, and family with what we need to be caught up with in our own reading. And that entwinement works as tightly as a double helix of a genetic code. It's very accomplished. And for anybody writing, it's a good measure of what you need to do at different points. You can't trust your reader to remember. Readers forget. Readers are distracted. They have to get the laundry out of the dryer. So it's important to stop the reader, to say, here's where we are, here's what you need to be remembering, and now I'll go on. And there are different points, whether it's a story or whether it's nonfiction, that you need to do that in order to keep your reader with you. And you need to do, we all need to do it with some degree of subtlety so we don't, as readers, feel ordered around. So that's what I think is really very important to know about this passage.
She's a brilliant teacher. I can see why she's at Vanderbilt. At least be speechless. Yes, that was, this book has, as you know, you didn't even try to pronounce the Kenyan names. Of course, that was one of the first things I had to deal with as a writer, is how do I get it authentic and trust that the reader will keep going through names that are difficult, they have no clue where these places are, how to pronounce them, and so on. And so that's why at various points I have to stop and let the reader familiarize themselves again with all of this. And so very early in the book, another point where I do that is right when I first introduce Western Kenya, mm-hmm. I try to compare the geography and the jurisdictions of Western Kenya to South Central Kansas, just so somebody can sort of get some bearings for where they are and how to follow it. I'm delighted that you chose that section because it was one of those places where I could feel this. What I try to do is reward the reader for what they've gone through by bringing everything together, because my books are very, I write, I think, in a straightforward manner, but there's a lot that's woven together. And so those places where I can show again how everything fits together in a fairly complex pattern, But do that in a simple way is what I find most rewarding in my books. And so I think that, there are probably four or five places in the book where I do that, including at the very end.
Yes.
Let's talk about pages 261 and 263 of Civic Passion.
I apologize for not being the professor that Professor Tichy is. So let me have a little bit of context to this first. I grew up in Madison, Wisconsin, the home of the progressive movement. So Cecilia's work is right at the heart of who I am as a human being. My father's newspaper, the Madison Capital Times, was founded by the progressives. So that's the fact that she chose civic activism in that progressive sense for this book was really delightful for me. I have to acknowledge there's some of these people that I knew quite well and some that I didn't know at all, and that's one of the rewards of the book. But what I found to be, the reason I chose Ida B. Wells, and it was, I would say half of why I chose it was because of the writing and half because of what I thought was the larger theme of the whole book. And I might be wrong, but this is what I sort of took out of it, was the notion of, you know, it's tough. That society throws a lot of bad things at us. And it has throughout history, culturally, economically, politically, in every possible way. And the essential choice that we have as citizens is whether we flee from all of that into our own private worlds or fight to try to improve it. Mm-hmm. And this section of Ida B. Wells, who, by the way, there's another little connection, which is Chicago and Obama. Mm-hmm. His first work in Chicago was in the projects, trying to clean them out of the asbestos that the poor predominantly black tenants were having to deal with, and he worked mostly at a project called Altgeld Gardens, but the first place that had this, that discovered this asbestos, was the Ida B. Wells housing in Chicago. So I'd studied Ida B. Wells because of that and some other things, but this section about her dealing with the whole issue of lynchings, which is just such it's probably of all of the scars on humanity and on America, and you know, the issue of race. I mean, there's so many, but lynchings are just the one that. And so this notion that she was not just going to fight, but she was going to fight with dynamite, which meant every possible fiber of her abilities in all of her journalistic and other ways. And so I don't know, the writing, the evocation of, sweet sentimental terms had their place, but she must marshal facts and couch them in biting irony and scathing indictment. There's so many different levels of this, of the writing in this part, and of thinking about how you confront evil or confront the society when it's going in the wrong path. That I just thought that dealing with Ida B. Wells in that way and using your language, which framed it so clearly, was struck me as sort of at the heart of this book.
Yeah. Yes, Wells, if maybe everybody in the room doesn't know Ida B. Wells Barnett, and when she married widower Barnett, she hyphenated her name, was one of the first to do that from a feminist sense, as you know. Writing about these seven individuals, and John, I remember in Word on Words you asked about Ida B. Wells particularly. They all were courageous people. They all went against the grain of the society at their time. They could have had much more conventional lives. Hmm. The others put their reputations on the line. She put her life on the line. She carried in her purse a pistol. I'm fortunate that my son-in-law's dad is a hunter and a gun collector, and I could say to him, what do you think that pistol was? And he, from his collection, pulled out a Navy pistol from the 19th century and dismantled it for me and showed me how it would work, because Ida Wells said, if they come after me, I can take at least one or two of them down with me.
That's she where was. This section that I picked out ends.
That tough, that tough, yes.
If a lynch mob came after, she'd take at least one of them down.
Right, right. An amazing heroine of our time still.
Yeah. I've got a giant question that's like three questions at once, but I'm sitting here and they all go together. Is one, this is the first time we've had people who've done nonfiction. And fiction, in a way, you just make it all up. In nonfiction, you got to find things and get it right. So my first part of the question is, how do you find out all this stuff? Because I don't understand how you, where you would even begin. That's one thought. But then the other thought is, you're dealing with, and she has seven pieces in her book, and he's about one person, but is there a moment when you go, oh, I got it, I understand what I'm doing now, and where was that moment as you were finding out all this stuff?
Dave.
Well, my books are based on what I call sort of four legs of a chair. And the first leg is go there, wherever there is. I believe deeply in absorbing myself in the place and the culture of what I'm writing about. I've said this before, but that meant when I was doing the biography of Vince Lombardi, it meant turning to my wife and uttering the immortal loving words, how would you like to move to Green Bay for the winter? And I guess I've been making it up to her ever since, taking her to Rome and Puerto Rico for Clemente and this book all over the world. We traveled, you know, 60,000 miles to do this book. So that's the first leg. I mean, it was only when I was in Western Kenya and walking the places of the Obama family's roots that I could really feel it in a deeper way. And the same in Indonesia especially, I would say. There was a moment when I was in the neighborhood of Mentang Dalam. Barry Obama lived in Indonesia from age 6 to almost 10. And he was completely immersed in that culture. You know, he wasn't protected by going to the international school and dealing with the other Western kids. He went to the local school. I had to learn Bahasa Indonesia, the local language, sink or swim with the kids. And it was really when I went there and walked through the narrow alleyways of Mentang Dalam, the neighborhood in South Jakarta, and listened to the sounds of the street vendors and the mosques and the hubbub of that life. It was really at that moment, it was one of those moments where I got it. I understood what an incredible journey, you know, from that little kid who for those 4 years went by his stepfather's name, Satoru. His mother had remarried to an Indonesian, Lolo Satoru. What an incredible journey, for whatever you think politically, from little Barry Satoru to President Obama. And what that, those 4 years, the sensibility that he had to develop from that as, you know, as the outsider, as someone who could learn how to adapt, who was open to the whole world. So that's the first leg, is going there. The second leg is archival research. And for this book, I went to 16 archives around the world. Interestingly, the entire Kenya National Archive is on microfilm at Syracuse University for bizarre reasons, which had to do with the fact that they had an Africanist department in the 1960s. And when Kenya got its independence, one of their top professors was very close to Jomo Kenyatta, who was the first president of Kenya. And the professor agreed that he and his assistants would help organize all of the archives if they could copy it all and bring it back to the States. Syracuse doesn't even have an Africanist department anymore, but that's where I found all of that. So it was ranging from there to the archives in Indonesia and in Kenya and in Hawaii and Chicago. Northwestern University has a wonderful Africanist archive where I was able to find a book that Barack Obama's father wrote, a series of little literacy books, because that's what he was doing before he came to Hawaii for a couple of years, and that's actually how he got to the whole Obama story. Really, one of those hinge points is that he was working for a literacy office in Nairobi, which was run by a Christian missionaries, basically. You know, so this whole notion of Muslim influence. You know, every step of the way, it was Christian evangelicals who were responsible for the Obama's rise. So archives all over the country really helped me. The third part is interviews, and for this book, I interviewed several hundred people, and the whole process is something that, as John knows so well, you learn as a journalist how to do it, so it's second nature to me. And I also understand that the luxury I have as an author is one that often as a journalist you don't have, which is to go back. For a bigger story at the Washington Post, I've always believed in that. Sometimes you only get one shot, but generally speaking, for when you're trying to get to the bottom of somebody, understanding someone, the first interview is almost worthless, except for one important thing, which is to make the personal connection with that person. But it's the more you know, the more the subject will talk. And so I'm constantly going back to people because I understand more, and that frees them up to trust me and talk more. Interviews, archives, observation, and the fourth one is just sort of using your brain, figuring it out. All of those three together, you know, to weave the story together, and so that's how I do these books.
Well, David has the advantage of live people to interview. I don't have that advantage. They're all gone, and so it's archival research. I went to the University of Chicago hoping that its special collections, its rare collection, would have lots about Ida B. Wells, only to learn that because of a fire, before any of her papers were put on deposit, a lot of her life documents were gone. I would say, if you're thinking to do a nonfiction project, you still have to tell a story, and a story that will be of interest. So I look for something that might go a little bit against the grain. Call it a hook. I think in journalism, don't you call something a hook? Isn't there a hook?
It's used,
is that
yeah.
one of the words?
Yeah,
okay. Yeah. One example, let me offer this, is the one of my seven figures is was a Baptist minister named Walter Rauschenbusch. His grandson, until recently, was the chaplain at Princeton. And that chaplain is also the grandson of Louis Brandeis. So two of these figures in my book, Walter Rauschenbusch, and of course Justice Brandeis from the Supreme Court and the university in his name, and the University of Louisville Law School named for Louis Brandeis. Walter Rauschenbusch, much less well known, but he wrote a book called Christianity and the Social Crisis. Now, we are now in what many, many writers, journalists have called the second Gilded Age. Gilded Age. We hear this all the time about wealth inequality, problems of joblessness, problems of housing, food scarcity. Our food pantries are at rock bottom these days. The demand is so high. So knowing this, I could cycle back a century to the first Gilded Age, and here's Walter Rauschenbusch, who right out of the seminary accepted a call to a very small and poor congregation in the Lower East Side of New York City. He found that his parishioners were just desperately in need of stability in their lives. They had no decent places to live. Their jobs, their wages were so minimal. It was the first time he had encountered really the depths of poverty in our country. And he determined to write about it. Now, there are at least two full-length biographies of him. And I noticed that there was a moment in his life after he had written his book and was within Christian Protestant circles very well known. But there was a moment when his biographer seemed embarrassed. That was a moment when Walter Rauschenbusch went into the Waldorf Astoria Hotel to give a talk to ladies in fancy hats and gentlemen in boiled shirts. So ladies have broad-brimmed hats with birds and feathers and all sorts of ribbons, a quite wealthy audience. The biographers were embarrassed because here was a minister going into the citadel of wealth. One of the corridors in the Waldorf is called Peacock Walk, because people would dress in their finest and just parade back and forth. I understand Mark Twain did some parading. Well, I thought that was just a terrific moment, and that should start my chapter, my story of Walter Rauschenbusch. I said, it's like he crossed the Rubicon. He went into the world of great wealth to tell wealth what its obligations ought to be. He went, so to speak, into the enemy camp. And rather than sort of diminish or hide or even not mention this, I thought this has to be the beginning of the chapter. He gets out of the carriage, he's come in on the train from Rochester where he lives, and the doorman in his brass buttons and his uniform opens the door for Rauschenbusch. He crosses that threshold, and that's the beginning of the story for me. So I look and I urge that if you're writing, whether it's maybe fiction or nonfiction, you look for that telling detail. I think the poet Ezra Pound used the phrase, the radiant gist, something like a gem that sparkles at you or to you, and you see you can make something of this that hasn't been made in the past. And I would say, take hold of it. That's your moment. That's what your reader would be interested in. That's what you are interested in. And pursue it. Whether you pursue it with live interviewees, and that's a wonderful opportunity, or whether you're digging in archives and documents from a century or more ago.
Cool. I have a question, David. What is the best thing you learned from a writing teacher? And the opposite of that is, what's a bromide that they all say that you disagree with?
Well, my best writing teacher was my father. I was incredibly lucky in that sense. My dad was a great newspaper man, and my mother was a book editor. And all my siblings are scholars. I was the dumb one in the family, you know. But from my dad, it was basically he taught me how to write clearly. You can write beautifully and clearly at the same time, and he had that capacity to do it. And really studying him and watching the way he did it was the most profound influence on me. And I would say that he was my main writing teacher. And it had to do with not exactly writing the way you speak, but more so that the reader feels immediately that you're talking to them. Mm-hmm. And so they're right with you the whole way. And there's no artifice to it. My dad was a huge lover of George Orwell's essays because of the incredible clarity that they had about looking at life the way it is and writing it that way. And so if Orwell influenced my dad influenced me in that same fashion.
Same question from the writing teacher or someone else.
In my first year of college at Penn State, my writing teacher was John Barth, the novelist. And he said, never tell more than 3/4 of your story. And what it meant is that the reader has to be able to participate and not feel closed out, not feel that it's a kind of a almost a vacuum and there's no place for the reader. So I have tried to not tell more than that 3/4. I would say also that if one is in the academic life, as I have been for decades, for which I'm very appreciative, it's not a place that encourages good writing for the most part. If you're in a journalism school, yes, you get a great mandate for clear writing. If you're in the world of scholarship, every sentence is likely to begin with the word although. And that is not a help to sounding like a human being on the page. So I find I have to fight to sound like a person. And I have written books that I would not want to tell you about because they start with far too many althoughs. So I would say any of us in the room who are in the world of scholarship, flee that world as you sit down to write your project and you'll be much better off. But don't tell more than 3/4 of your story.
The other thing my father always told me is unpack the story. That was his phrase.
What does that mean?
That means don't rush it. Don't try to force everything into the first paragraph or 3 paragraphs, but just let it unfold naturally. And that's one of those things that gets the reader to want to follow you along. And so, you know, that's something I learned for my daily journalism, but it's something that I've also, you have more of that luxury in writing a book. You know, you want the reader to read it all the way to the last word. So you don't, you know, so just let it flow. Don't force all of your various contradictory thoughts, in which causes the all those, into the first page.
Well, try not to be fancy. I found that sometimes writers are trying to sound like they're smarter or more important or something. And the clarity thing is so crucial because they got to understand it. If they don't understand it, then what have you done? Impressed 12 people who do, but the rest of the world.
Well, there are brilliant philosophers who I don't understand, who I respect nonetheless. But it would take 4 or 5 readings to comprehend. And their thoughts are so complex that they couldn't do it any other way. But there are other people who don't have complex thoughts but hide that with their words. And those are the ones that you can find out right away. They're the phonies.
Do you have a writing mantra that you say or that you run through your head as you go? I've got to be sure I can do this or don't do that.
Well, mostly I'm sitting there thinking, find me a verb. Isn't there a good verb here, a good action? I think because you sit down to write, you can become sedentary. I think it's David Foster Wallace, I believe it's he, who generated 3 pages of verbs, and I printed it out. I would like to say that I've benefited from these verbs, verbs like twiddle and launch and trigger, and I go down the list and I have not found one. But I do think it's really important to have some good verbs. People like to feel there's action going on, and that's for me a real challenge and a dogfight.
That's good.
What would you say are personality traits or skills that a biographer needs? A good one.
Oh, you know, I hate to generalize about that, but the ability to submerge yourself into see life from someone else's perspective. You can write an interesting book that frames another person in your perspective of the world, but that's not great biography. Great biography is seeing it from the inside out. And so I think that's the most important characteristic, besides all of the skills of research and of organization, et cetera. It's that ability to try to understand. I mean, that's what motivates me in everything I do, is try to understand why people are the way they are and what are the forces that shaped them. And I think you have to have that curiosity to be a great biographer.
I hope you mentioned contradiction, because there's a page in here I wanted to ask you about from your book, is because I write, well, essentially fiction, screenplays, and that's a big, who the character is in the story you're telling. And you talk about Ida B. Wells as she blew money on clothes, essentially. She also splurged to have her hair styled and hired a dressmaker to fashion the delectable dress that cost almost half a month's salary, which is not like the Ida B. Wells that I thought I was going to find. It was so interesting to see that contradiction. How was that helpful to you?
Well, it's terrific. She wanted to look good. She wanted to feel good. You know, she got out of you know, rural Mississippi. I mean, born into slave times. Gets to Memphis. Life is more stylish. She wants to participate. She should participate. Now, if you don't, as if you're writing, let's say you're doing a profile of maybe a family member or someone, and here with David's book, a book that seeks to understand, we are all a mass of contradictions. If you don't allow those contradictions into a portrait of a life, you end up with allegory. With a character who's all one thing, and then the other characters become all one thing too. Now, in the Middle Ages, allegory was very well appreciated on the stage. You know, you get the angel and the devil, and we know who wins. But in these times, to do a biographical portrait, you want to get the full sense of a person. So it's wonderful that in Ida's purse is her pistol, and she has a wonderful hairstyle and a beautiful dress, and later she wasn't broke all the time for having spent her money on her personal appearance.
You know, I've spent a lot of my career writing about politics, and politics is the antithesis of great writing. It demands, the political culture demands everything to be viewed in black and white. And somebody's either good or bad. And if you write about somebody who you might admire, but show the warts of them, you'll get bombarded, in this era particularly, with people criticizing you. How dare you, you know, write about this aspect of Bill Clinton or Barack Obama. But in fact, what I'm trying to do is infuse them with life. You know, as Cecilia said, all of us know that we are contradictory, that we might believe in one thing, but there's a part of us that sees the seeds of the opposite view, and that whatever we're, you know, however noble we're acting, we have all these other thoughts running through our mind, and we do have these contradictions. I mean, Vince Lombardi, the great football coach, who believed in sort of teaching his players to play through pain, was a complete wimp. You know, if he got a little hangnail, he would be out for weeks. You know, and that's what makes him human. You know, and so I think that all of my effort is to present people in their totality, and I think that makes them more relatable, and my enormous frustration in dealing with this transitory political, somewhat sick modern political culture is that people are, because they feel they're in such a tight ideological struggle, they can't accept the humanity, even of people they like or dislike.
In your book, I want back to Ida B. Wells. She goes to, is it Cairo, Illinois?
Mm-hmm.
She goes there, and that's like the whole centerpiece for the piece.
And I'm imagining that in doing your research at the beginning of it, you may not have known about that trip, or let's say you found out about it, but how did you decide that that was going to be the linchpin that you hung the whole story on?
This is an important issue for all of us planning to write. What story are you going to tell? A friend of mine, Thaddeus Davis, has written the huge biography of Nella Larsen. And I heard her say in a gathering such as ours a few years ago, as a biographer, you need to decide what story. Now, with Wells, there are many episodes, and in later life, beyond this Cairo horror, where there had been a lynching, and she went down. It looked like there was going to be more lynching, and she was going to stop it. Later on, she went into a prison in Arkansas. A whole group of men, black men, who had just given up hope of staying alive. They were scheduled to be hanged. She went into that jail and said, "Buck up, start singing freedom songs, and stop this moaning at once." And they did. And she marshaled her forces. Now, in a way, I've got these, there are these two events. Which one? The reason I chose the Cairo one is that it also had a family story behind it. That is, someone had to go down to Cairo. The NAACP had just been formed. Ida's husband, Barnett, an attorney, at the dinner table basically said, "So, your train leaves in the morning." And she basically thought, "Why me? Are these men? We're all these men. NAACP, why don't they do it?" She went off to upstairs for the night, good night. And I knew what her favorite food was, a sort of stew, and I assumed that they might be having that stew, so I could put that in. And one of her sons, one of the children, came to her and said, "Mama, basically, if you don't do it, no one will do it." So I had that story, and that the next day the family went to the train station to see her off, and I had from document what that train station looked like, the stained glass, the light through the window, the image and the glass etched. And I thought, this is the story then, because it comes out of her family, it sends her off down to Cairo, and that will make a better story, and it will tell the same story of how she goes as a crusader into the Deep South that she swore she would never go back down into again, after from Memphis, working on an African-American newspaper in which she had a major claim. She published a courageous editorial. The office was trashed, her life threatened. It was assumed she was a man. At the time she was in Philadelphia, she swore she would never go back south, but she did it in the cause of anti-lynching, and she saved lives, rallying people. So it had that family story, and I knew that was the one to tell. So as my friend Thad Davis said, you have to decide what story you're going to tell. David is a master of telling an array of stories and bringing them all together and keeping them in place. But probably there still were other stories you could have told, and they're not here. It seems complete, but I'll bet you could
always.
Yeah.
And Cairo, Illinois, for those of you who don't know, is the Deep South. It's closer to Mississippi, Jackson, Mississippi, than Chicago, Illinois.
Years ago, I wrote an awful play, and it was awful because I did too much research. It was about a real person. I interviewed everybody that was alive that had ever known him, and I read everything I could find. And by the time I sat down to write my play, my head was clogged, and I couldn't figure out what my story was. And so I ended up doing a terrible draft and throwing it away. Which I should probably come back now and do nothing except write it, and it might be okay. But now when I approach something, I do a little teeny bit of research
But a screenplay is so far fewer words and pages than a book. But I do enough research to figure out who my characters are and what the story is, get a draft and tell my story, and then go in and do my research. And so research for me in some ways is kind of scary because I had to kill an idea because I did too much. Mm-hmm. How do you approach research, and does this kind of thing ever come up with for you that you...
That I've researched too much?
Or do you find your story first, or how do you...
There have been, earlier on in my career, there were a couple of times when I did massive amounts of research and didn't have a clue what the hell I was doing with it. And luckily I learned that lesson early before I started my first book. I almost did a book on Gary Hart in 1984, in that period, and I had learned all these organizational methods from my colleague Bob Woodward about cutting and pasting, and I probably had 1,000 pages of stuff on Gary Hart, but I didn't know what I was talking about. And that was, luckily, I learned that before my first book was Bill Clinton, which was 92, so that was 8 years later. And by then I had sort of learned the lesson before I had to suffer in terms of it being a book. So by that point, I realized that I don't know where the specifics of the story are going to go, and I'm always open to that. But I had to realize, what's motivating me here? Why do I want to write this book? What are the questions that I want to answer? And so for Bill Clinton, it was, he was the first person from my generation to make it to the White House. The title of the book is First in His Class. He was never first in his class. Literally, he was never in class. He was one of those guys who, when he was at Yale Law School, he'd be down in Texas organizing for McGovern the whole semester and then come back the last week, borrow someone else's notes, and get better grades than they did. But he was the first member of his generation to make it. So, why him? Coming out of nowhere in Arkansas. And being a Rhodes Scholar with 31 other young men, at that point they were all men, all of whom thought they were going to be president. So why was Clinton the guy? And so it was that drove me through the whole book. And with Barack Obama, there were two, some people have read this, I'm planning on doing two volumes, but some people read this book and say, why isn't he there until the seventh chapter? It's because that's my choice. And it's because of that, my asking the first questions, which were two things that motivated me for this book. One was, we're all random creatures, but who's more random than Barack Obama? The unpredictability of his existence is enormous, and the universality of it is fascinating. And so I saw in his story a chance to write about the modern world through the various threads of his families. So the first motivation was find out really about the world that created Barack Obama. And then, given the contradictions into which he was born, how did he figure it out? Mm. So that's it. The world that created Obama and how he created himself. That's the book I wanted to write.
And you knew that.
And I knew that going in. I didn't know where it would, I knew where I had to go. I had a lot of questions. But that was the overarching motivation for my book, and that's what I needed. I didn't have it with Gary Hart. I didn't really care about him, in any larger way, and I didn't know what the question was. So I have to have that question.
Yeah. Well, when I decided to write Civic Passions, coming out of literature. So many novels, this, or stage plays, people have all slaughtered each other or expired at the end. I wanted to write something about individuals who made a really positive difference in our society. People who, against, and said earlier, all odds, took on causes. Alice Hamilton, a young lady out of Fort Wayne, Indiana. A genteel family. She was a lady, not just a woman, a lady, meaning genteel, meaning you don't raise your voice. You cross your legs at the ankle and never the knee. and you know a fish knife and a pickle fork, all the silver implements that the Sterling Silver manufacturers make. How did she get herself to medical school, the University of Michigan, and beyond that, living in Chicago, a lot of Chicago in this book, how is it that she noticed that the illnesses of smelter and iron worker and families, workers, the illnesses were not because their wives couldn't cook or because they'd been drunk and were hungover, but because they were being poisoned by lead and other toxic metals. She became a pioneering industrial toxicologist, first woman professor at Harvard University, a founder of the whole field that we now recognize of public health in the workplace. So I want, and she pushed on against great odds. They all did, these seven people. I'm now writing a book on Jack London because I think fiction is also an important venue, I'll call it, for changing the public mind and bringing about policies that help us on the whole. What did he care about? He had been, this is Jack London, a child laborer in a jute mill and a cannery. He saw people's fingers sliced off in the cannery. In the jute mill, he worked for 10 cents an hour in shifts ranging 14, 16 hours. He said one shift was 36 hours straight, and you left when the boss told you you could leave. His family was poor. Well, his fiction tells these stories and makes the plea for a change in public opinion toward public policies and better laws to protect children, get children out of the workplace. When our former Speaker of the House of Representatives, Newt Gingrich, suggested this past autumn that poor boys in poor schools might learn discipline if they were hired as janitors in their schools, and there was a whole howl about that. That's the vestige of the child labor era, and we don't want that to come back. So I would say you find somebody you care about, something that has made a big difference, and you anchor yourself in that. I have to admit, I do way more research. After all, if you're in academic life, you have other scholars who know a lot about the topic, and they're ready poised to go at you if you make mistakes. And of course, there always are some mistakes. But finally, as others have said, I use about 10% of the research I do. So Vanderbilt's collecting my papers, and they get all the files of the other folders that I'm fortunately not having to use. So I over-research.
Well, it's hard not to. Yeah. Research is fun. Writing's hard. And you
I want to ask you all for questions in just a second, but I've got a couple more. Is there a difference between good research and show-offy research when it's in the book?
Sure.
How do you know the difference?
I wish I did all the time, but... show-offy, I don't think I've ever used show-offy research, but I know that there are times when I probably just go off in a direction because I'm interested in it. And that's for good or worse. You know, you don't know if you're taking the reader with you or not. But in the end, you have to write the book that you want to write. So I, my own self-critique is probably... that I don't think there's such a thing as over-researching, but there's sometimes when I probably use 12% instead of 10%. but show-offy research would be anything that is completely extraneous to the story. Doesn't add to the reader's. I think you can, particularly in a long book, there are times when you have to allow the reader to breathe, and that's where I'm looking for that the ancillary stories, and I don't think that's show-offy. But it's an effort on my part to, you know, you're so intensely into the ascent of someone or the travails of someone. You want to take a little bit of a you know, go off on a side road for a little while, just to maybe to add humor to it, or to add some way of comparing this person's life with someone else's. That's the way I'm always, or to illuminate an aspect of the geography or history of a culture of a place that, you know, you just I don't think those are show-offy unless they go on for too long or they're I don't know. I've never been accused of being a show-off. So
I don't know if show-offy is even a word.
But
my last question for you all is, if it was Fellini's birthday, was I think last week, and there was a quote I read, if I set out to make a film about a filet of soul, it would be about me. And I want to know, what did you learn about you in writing these two books?
You go first.
Oh yeah, go. Thanks so much. I think I learned about my political passion. I went to high school in Fairmont, West Virginia. I had teachers who had come back from the larger world, I'm going to say the larger world, during the Depression to help out their families, so I had the advantage of those teachers. Right out of high school, I worked at the Owens, Illinois glass plant on rotating shifts, and I hope a member still in good standing of the Glass Bottle Blowers Association. And later, I was a member of the Amalgamated Meat Cutters when I worked supermarket. In those days, so young, I worked alongside young people my own age who never were going to go to college, but because they could earn a good hourly wage at Owens or in the supermarket, they would have middle-class lives. Young woman beside me just bought a new Chevy that summer, blue and white. Those were the days of two-tone cars, color cars. And I didn't understand at the time what that summer meant to me and those later jobs. But now I see very clearly, as our middle class struggles, what it has meant for the individuals I profile in that book, and for Jack London, that I'm now so involved with, that these were people of such political courage, and I think I learned where my own fervor is in this time through writing this book.
You had time to think about it.
Well, there's so many things. I mean, I've learned that I'm incredibly lucky because I'm doing something that I love to do, and there's nothing, I'm completely incompetent at everything else. Can't change a light bulb. Every book that I'm doing, I remind myself how lucky I am I'm doing it. I've sort of, over the course of 10 books, I don't think I've changed my sensibility, but it's deepened. And so I feel more of my own voice coming through. I've never wanted to preach to the choir. And that's, you know, so I've tried, you know, it's taken, it's in this culture again, it's made it somewhat more difficult for me. I've always wanted to have my books open to as many, to readers coming at it from as many different places as possible, and yet to have my sensibility running through it at the same time, without, I mean, obviously I have my own biases and ideology, and they're probably in some fashion underlying what I'm doing, but my largest motivation, as I said before, is to try to understand from the inside what I'm writing about. And I think that that's taught me about myself, that you know, I do have that sort of universal perspective on people and movements and so on. And so that's what I think infuses my books.
Good answers, both of them.
Who's got a question? Yes, sir.
Nonfiction, history, and biography in particular, it's interesting that a number of the really good works that I think are good come from the ranks, professional ranks, of journalists rather than historians. And I studied history in college, and for some reason I think I came away with the impression that the legitimate
Let me repeat the question for the camera is how can writers who are not PhDs in history do it?
You know, John Barry, who I think worked for the New York Times for a good number of years, wrote a book called Rising Tide about the Great Mississippi Flood of 1927, a brilliant book, a wonderful book. I heard a academic scholarly historian at my university, Vanderbilt, dismiss this project as not by a real historian. Well, I just said, oh, and went on my way. I just think, you know, a good journalist is worth weight in gold. And whether you've got an advanced degree or not is not about whether you have the ability to really do the research and put that story together. So I think that's a false distinction. Lots of academic historians, though, do very well in the trade book market. Douglas Brinkley is one. He's at Rice University now. His books are very readable and enviably frequent.
Or on it, yes. I agree. I think it's a phony distinction, and I think that perhaps one advantage that those who came out of journalism have is that they're motivated by two instincts. One is to tell a story. So the narrative aspect of history is more part of their own life's work, as opposed to, and it's broader. I think that they tend to have perhaps a, I don't want to generalize, but so I won't speak about academic historians, but journalists generally, it's tell a story, and it's find the real story, you know, what's behind, and so that they have a tendency perhaps. To go beyond just archival materials and look for other ways of getting to the root of the story. But I've always tried to hold myself to the standards of serious historians. So my books are always completely sourced in the back, which I think is the first thing I look at when I'm looking at any book. I think you can learn a lot from the source notes of any book as to whether someone really did the work or not. So I've tried to have it so that my books are taught by historians, and they are. You know, so I know that there's always going to be, for some reason, journalists are more communal than academics. You know, I mean, we're all competitive, but I don't think there's that same sort of, for instance, I work at the Washington Post, our arch enemy is the New York Times. If they do a great story, it's a great story, and I'm not going to piss on it, you know. But academics have that, you know, they sort of feel more proprietary, perhaps, sometimes.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a monastic kind of training.
Yeah.
Kind of swapping... help and across the desk, so that's really not so much a part of it. You take your courses and then you go off in your hole and write your dissertation. Well, then that takes hold as the way to do things. Mm. Too bad.
Yes, sir.
Both of you have said about writing nonfiction, tell a story. And I'm a documentary filmmaker and know a little bit about screenwriting, but the telling of the story starts with the setup and classic. And both of you have described the way you describe it in particular, how you set it up. And after that, there is no story without conflict, and then there's finally the point that you come to resolution. It seems to me that that's a pretty good model for history telling as well, or whatever the story is that is nonfiction, is to use that model, is tell a story in which somebody can get grabbed on the hook early enough so that they get through two or three pages and they don't want to turn it down. But it seems to me that screenwriting and that have a nice little fit together in terms of kind of traditional storytelling.
I don't think that, I mean, I think documentary film and nonfiction narrative are kin, you know, very much so.
Yeah. And if I might just add, very recently, I've seen it put forward that what we all want is a narrative, a story, it's what you're saying, and what doesn't work as well is just data, you know. All this data is sprung at us all the time, and we're kind of deer in the headlights, kind of immobilized by it. But put in a story with its own arc, that's everything.
And I've always maintained that, you know, as the technology of my professions are changing at such rapid speeds, that particularly when I talk about newspapers, I've come to, you know, I might prefer the old, I mean, for the rest of my life, I'm going to read a real newspaper. But what I try to say in the optimistic sense is that humans will always have a need for story, in whatever format it's told. And there always will be a need for people to go out and find what the real story. So as long as those two things are there, my profession will transform but still be healthy.
Dave, I am a seeker of truth, which is what I identify myself on my Twitter account as, and my first experience with y'all will be buying this book immediately because I am completely impressed with the level of commitment that you have given to actually come up with the research for the book. My question is, what would you say to Donald Trump?
What would I say to Donald Trump? It's unprintable. But I've said it. do you want me to really go into that? The best thing to do with Donald Trump is to ignore him. You know, even to respond to him is giving him what he wants, which is just more celebrity. So, his efforts and that sheriff out in Arizona, you know, or all of these birthers, it's such complete garbage. And my book, in great detail, shows the real story of Barack Obama's birth. But I don't want to even give Trump any more than, and you're a woman of the church, so I don't want to use the words I would use.
Great question. Great answer.
Different question. Long time ago, I don't know about now, in screenwriting, you have your end, and then you create an obstacle for your hero to get to the goal. When you decide to write about a person's life, I assume you think you know enough about them to find them interesting. Has there ever been an instance when, where your research has changed your opinion of that person? And if it has been, were you flexible and let the details write themselves?
So the question is, did your research ever change your opinion of your subject, and how'd you deal with that?
You know, years back, several years ago, I wrote a book about country music. I'd moved to Nashville, and in a way, it was my move-in book. I think I just about did our family in going to clubs to listen to music into the wee hours and then having to get up in the early, you know, crack of dawn. I decided at the outset I would only write about the artists, the vocalists, and the instrumentalists I admire. And so if sort of if you didn't get into that book, it's you're, you know, whatever. We have all seen, I think, biographies in which the biographer turns on his or her mm-hmm. subject, and by the end is really in an adversarial position. There's a biography of Jack London that ends with some statement that says, "The finest body that ever was given to a human being, ruined deliberately." You know, and it's sort of like, oh, it's just this last blast. It's so regrettable that to engage in biographical, in a sense, intimacy with a subject, and then turn on that person who's not in a position to defend itself, and sort of turns you sour. I don't want to be, you know, taking Rolaids and Tums because of who I've decided to write about. Maybe you have a different view.
I agree completely. I mean, pathography is not what I'm interested in.
Pathography.
But I will say that of all the people I've written about, Bill Clinton was the most contradictory. And there were parts of his life where I was truly, you know, impressed and moved by, you know, like for instance, when he first went out to the University of Arkansas to be a law professor, and it was the first wave of African American students at the University of Arkansas Law School, and they had no mentors, and many of them were foundering and having difficulty, and Clinton took it upon himself to be their champion, and had special tutoring classes for them all, or classes for them all, and they called him Wonder Boy, and he really, he didn't save, but he lifted a whole generation of law students there who were, you know, and that was, you know, I think that race was always the better side of Bill, has been the better side of Bill Clinton's nature. And so when I was writing that chapter, you know, I was rooting for the guy. And then there's other chapters where you can see where the clash, the inherent clash that every human being has between idealism and ambition. Ambition was winning in some rather uglier ways. And so I didn't like him in those chapters. And as I was, this is my first book. And as I was finishing the book, the last 3 months of writing that book were the hardest 3 months I've had in any of my books. And it was because I was new at the art of biography. And I was thinking, here I've invested all these years of research trying to understand this person. And in the end, do I like him or not? Is he good or is he bad? And for a couple months, that was just haunting me. And then, of course, it all lifted. And I said, well, he's all of that. And it was that understanding that has really saved me from then on, to understand that people are these contradictions. And Bill Clinton is just an exaggeration of all of us in every possible way.
two questions. What book impacted you the most? And second, how would you like to be remembered? And David, I'm sure that you do a lot of research for all your interviewees, and I'm sure Barack Obama may have challenged you on some interpretations. What surprised you in that experience, and what are some of the similarities between Obama and Bill Clinton?
Why don't you take the first question first?
You know, life-changing books, I love the idea of life-changing books, but I don't think any one book has ever been that book for me. You know, from, of course, teaching American literature, it's just such a bounty. And And right now, you know, we're working on thinking about Jack London's work, and I would say there's a book called The Sea Wolf that I think is very powerful in his, and that sea captain in that book, I think, is London seeing one of the captains of industry of his time, like Carnegie or Rockefeller, and the power, the extreme power that such figures had over the society, over the people who worked in their companies. And that's a book in which I think London is saying, these titanic figures must be neutralized for the sake, for the well-being of everyone. Now it's indirect in a sense, because he's got to sell books, he's earning his living as an author. So right now I'm particularly admiring that book. To be remembered, I've been a teacher for many years, and I know in the classroom in which I was a student, sometimes an offhand remark by a faculty member would just be the crystallizing statement. I would like to think that through decades, forgive me, I'm tearing up, because in the last year or so, I had two letters from students I most remember. I taught them in my first year at Boston University. And they wrote to tell me what it meant to be in my class. I had no idea. Those letters came out of the blue. And I would like to think that the time some students have spent with me over the years have made a positive impact on their lives.
Like Cecilia, I don't know that there's one book that changed my life. The book I read as a little boy that stuck with me for a lot of different reasons was a picture book called Paddle to the Sea, about this little Indian in a canoe that went from Minnesota all the way through the St. Lawrence Seaway. And I suppose that, and it told the story of the Great Lakes through this. And I suppose it was that I've always, in all of my books, geography is really important to me. And I think geography is underappreciated and underestimated in its influence on humanity in all of its forms. And so I think that has been, without even realizing the connection, I think that book was this sort of the first spark in me about geography and writing. And so it had a very profound influence. But ranging from, as I said earlier, Orwell's essays, which to me have an incredible ability to frame things that we've probably all thought about, but frame them anew in a clearer way, which is something that I admire greatly. The common sense of it. I don't read modern fiction very much, but I did read a lot of Russian literature, and that. So Chekhov is a major influence as well. Your question about Obama, remind me
what surprised you in your interview?
In my interview with him? He did not. So I'll tell you one story that will sort of side into what you're at. I did not interview President Obama until the very last. It was the last interview I did. And that was on purpose. I wanted to go into the Oval Office knowing more about his family's life than he knew. and I wanted him to know that. So I let him, I gave his press secretary the introduction to my book and also a table of contents of the book. The introduction so that the president would have a sense of all the places I've gone and some of my conclusions. And the table of contents because there were a few names in that very bare table of contents that would mean something to Barack Obama, not to anyone else on his staff. So you know, I could have done that with Bill Clinton and he wouldn't have read a thing. I knew that President Obama is a writer. He was taking it seriously and that he would read it, and he did. So, and I also knew that this was our first real meeting after, you know, I knew so much about him, and how am I gonna break the ice with him? And, you know, he's a jock, right? And I've written a lot about sports, and I love sports too, and he's a Bears fan, and I'm a Packers fan. So I knew that was the deal. So I was, forgive those of you who don't care about football, but 2 years ago, the Bears played the Packers in the NFC Championship game to determine who would go to the Super Bowl. And Obama in the White House, as a Bears fan, declared, if the Bears win this game, I'm going to the Super Bowl. And the Packers won. And after the game, one of the great Green Bay Packers players, Charles Woodson, got on a table in the dressing, you know, in the room afterwards, and said, you know, President Obama won't come see us in the Super Bowl. We're going to go see him at his house. Meaning if we win, we get to go to the White House. So they won, and they went to the White House. So I'm walking into the Oval Office, and my first words were, Mr. President, Charles Woodson got here before me, but I'm glad we both finally made it. And he said, you know, which he's quick, he said, man, those Packers were rough on me. And I said, well, deservedly so, you're a Bears fan. And he said, yeah, but every time I go to Wisconsin, they give me another share of Packer stock. It's a publicly owned team, which is one of the reasons I love them. And so they give, you know, Obama has more Packer stock than I do. And then, so that sort of broke the ice. And then as we were getting started, he said, David, I read your introduction. It's very well written. But, you know, you call my book fiction. And I replied, no, Mr. President, actually, I complimented you. I called it literature. And that has to do with the differences between what he wrote in his book and what I found at various points. It's not a gotcha thing with me. I mean, I wasn't trying to say President Obama, you know, the right wing could latch onto parts of it. As I was talking about earlier about the difficulties of trying to write honestly about things in this ideological atmosphere, I was just making the point that there are differences between memoir and serious biography, and that some of the stories in his book were just family mythology that he passed along, and he wasn't expecting a biographer to come along afterwards and find out what really happened, you know, like talking about his Indonesian stepfather, who in his book he says was killed as a martyr fighting the Dutch in the fight for independence in Indonesia. And when I was in Indonesia, I discovered that step-grandfather actually died falling off an ottoman in his living room, changing the drapes. You know, there's a difference, you know? But one's the story that the family passed along, and one's the reality. So we went through that, and actually it wasn't confrontational. What President Obama ended up saying is, David, you know, I didn't have a researcher. Kind of a little bit lame, but you know, you're probably right. You know, instance after instance, when we went through it, he said, you're probably right. So he was learning things from me in that sense. I found him to be, answer the questions. I could interview Bill Clinton. You know, Clinton's an incredibly talented guy, but I interviewed him many times in the 92 campaign, and one time he knew that I was interested in a subject that he didn't want to talk about. I got into the limousine with him in downtown Milwaukee. He was going to the airport. It was 50 minutes. And he spoke the entire time without letting me ask a single question. He filibustered brilliantly. It was interesting, but it wasn't what I wanted to know. And Barack Obama actually addressed the questions. Not always completely, but he took it seriously, and it was a, you know, for that reason, it was one of those interviews where I came out, I always come out of an interview thinking, oh, I blew it. I didn't really get what I wanted. But when I transcribed it, I realized I got more than I thought.
Have you got a question?
No, I'm just so lucky this is all being videotaped. we're lucky to have had the three of you here today. And I think everybody here would share my view on that. I think for our writers, so I thank all of you for coming and hope you'll come again. And David, to see you, Will, thank you all so much for giving us another great afternoon.
Thank you very much, and don't forget your homework for the 7th grade.